We are celebrating Insight's 15th birthday this summer by listening back to some of our favorite topics and guests. Today, we're going backstage at Sacramento's comedy scene to find out about what it takes to make people laugh. Yassine Mazen is a Sacramento State student who draws from his experience as an Iraqi-American refugee. He has big dreams and a pro-level work ethic to make a name for himself.
I look weird. I get it. Like, I look weird. I look like a grandpa and a grandson at the same time.
Then Keith Lowell Jensen talked about taping his latest comedy album, Unclean, for his new record label. And we'll revisit Nick Bruner's conversation with Hari Kondabolu. And I'll preview the Sacramento stand-up competition this weekend. I'm Randall White. That's all today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host and MC, Randall White. Today, we're taking a look at the local comedy scene by getting to know funny people on and off stage. Yassine Mazen is a Sacramento State student with big dreams of making a name for himself. He grew up in Iraq and had to relocate with his family to Jordan in 2006, and then Sacramento in 2008. His comedy focuses on making the refugee experience relatable for American audiences. I spoke with him earlier this month and started by asking him about quitting his job to focus on getting more stage time.
The more time you put into something, obviously the better you're going to get at it. And that's what really stand-up is really, that's how you get a grasp of it. The more you're on stage, the more comfortable you are, the more rooms you experience. The more experience you have in dealing with those certain rooms, you kind of start seeing patterns in different venues and different clubs. So you just, the more you do it, the more comfortable you are, and that's just how it is.
Now, you were able to quit your job, but quitting schooling would be a whole different thing, right? Because your parents do not want the comedy to get in the way of your education.
Right. I think it's all about balancing things. One, I know comedy is not going to support me financially. Like, I'm so aware of that. So having just that degree to get that and then hopefully getting some form of job, that would be really nice. But ultimately, my goal is to do comedy full time.
And so possibly, like right now, you don't think it'll support you, but you do foresee a future where it's your main source of income?
Oh, I have to. I have to see that, yeah. There is a goal in my mind, and finances are not really the main drive force, but wherever I want to go with comedy, I think, money is going to be involved.
No, but for real, have you guys, like, seen any other Iraqis, or am I the first one you've seen live, or anyone seen Iraqis? Have you met anyone? No? Okay, you guys, either cowards or liars. Okay, thank you. Brave. Thank you so much. But that's the thing, like, there is more of us. Like, I used to, when I first came here, there was not a lot, and, like, I used to meet them and be like, oh, yeah, like, what's up, buddy? And now they're all over the place, and I hate it. But, like, you guys know that that song that goes, war, ooh, yeah, what is it good for? Immigrants. That's what that does.
Because my goal is to be someone, right? So if I'm going in it for the money, I sound like half the population of the world.
If not more.
If not more, exactly. So I think it was really important at some point, like, in my head, like, I fantasize about the money and stuff, and I get excited. But really, like, where is that? I could do that with anything. But so I had to set aside a different goal, and I have to really feel myself, do I approve of that goal? And that was when, once I got there, then comedy became a different game for me.
At what point did you realize that you're funny?
Oof. I think I realized as far as comedy or just in general and as a person?
I guess in general. And when did you think you could apply that to a career?
Okay, so in middle school, because I moved out of Iraq and then moved into Jordan, and then it just seemed like my way of making friends was to be funny. And then just watching people laugh and making people laugh, they listen to me when I'm making them laugh. So that's when I felt like, oh, I am this person. I'm a funny person now because that's how I cope with things. And then being a stand-up comic, I became obsessed with it once I moved into the U.S. around eighth grade. And I would talk about wanting to do stand-up in high school, and some kids would be like, oh, yeah, we're going to meet up. You should just come around and just do something for us, I'd be like, no. Like, I would get so nervous. But we had to meet that goal.
Where are those nerves now when you get up there and there's just silence on the other end after you've told what you think is a really funny joke?
Oh, those nerves are... So when I get a silence, like a joke that bombed, I realize, like I said, it's a pattern thing. So I always understand that there was some form of way that I lost people. So it could have been like at a bar show where the people are drunk and I'm talking too fast, and then they just simply didn't hear some of the vital words that they needed to hear. Or I could have just simply threw off someone just because I tried some crowd work or something that just drove away from my message.
And I don't know if you could tell from the way I'm standing, but I really want to be a comedian. And my parents hate that I'm doing this because they're like, dude, we got you out of Iraq and you're still bombing.
You either tell a joke or you perform a joke. When you tell a joke, you just sound like a script. And a lot of people will catch on to that, and it will lose a lot of its value. But if you're performing the joke and it's in that moment, that very moment that the person is seeing you and you're doing it for them, then that's going to hit differently. So you just get used to realizing that, oh, I messed up.
I don't know, man. I don't know if you could tell from the way I'm standing, but I really want to be a comedian. I usually get like an aw, but okay. That's cool. But like, I told my parents that, and they hate it. They're like, you suck. No, they're like, really? Like, this is, we got you out of Iraq, and you're still bombing? Like, just go to school. Do you not get the hint? Like, that's all we want.
I used to blame the audience at times because I would think, oh, no, they didn't. But then I realized, no, there are people that are doing way better than I am right now on stage. So they did something right. I'm the one that's doing something wrong.
So yeah. If you bombed, it's not necessarily the joke that needs changing. It's the performance.
Oh, yeah. It's a little bit of both. You could always take out pieces and put in different pieces of the joke. But the performance, I think, is always because a performance can make a bad joke funny.
Yeah. Have your parents seen your shows?
So funny thing is, they actually saw me, I want to say like 2 months in, when I was telling like the worst type of comedy that I didn't want them to be there. They just showed up unannounced.
Oh, you didn't know they were coming.
I didn't know that it was at the Comedy Spot. And my cousins were in town, so they knew I was doing this. So I was like, okay, you guys are from Canada. You should come check out, no diss on Canada, but like you should come check out like this thing, because I think you guys would like it, and they were very invested in it. And then out of nowhere, they're my cousins, and then their parents, and then my parents and sister and brother, they all just showed up randomly, and I had to go out there and tell the worst. And I just realized, you know what?
When you say the worst, you mean like dirty jokes? Like
dirty jokes, yeah. But like things that I don't tell anymore, you know what I mean? Like I have one premise that's still relevant. And that's just because it was about my background. But that's pretty much it. The rest was garbage.
Do you have a deal with your parents now? Like, you can't come until I hit a certain point? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I had that deal originally, which they just betrayed. And but after that, they, like, I could see the disappointment in their faces. And I'm just like, remember, I told you this. This is step one. We're going to build our way up. And then they're like, okay, whatever, we don't improve. But then I kind of just did it silently. I didn't really tell them that I was out doing this. And I did that for about a year until, obviously, I built up more credit. I built up better material. And then all of a sudden, they see me, like, posting, like, I'm doing this show, doing that show. And then people in our Iraqi community are asking, oh, your son's, like, doing this. And they're like, oh, he is? He's still doing that? But then now that I'm getting cred for it, and then people are interested, so they kind of, like, are seeing, oh, maybe he is getting better. And then eventually, like, they started talking to me about it again, where I was telling them, oh, yeah, all that stuff is gone now. I have way better stuff. But regardless, I don't want them there yet. I want them to come to the special. You know what I mean? When it's all done and finalized, like the final draft, then they can come.
The one that's being filmed for HBO.
Exactly, yeah.
We're speaking with Yassim Mazen about being a stand-up comic and his influences, including his early life in Iraq. You play a lot on the fact that you are an Iraqi American in right. your comedy. Who are your influences? Are there Iraqi comedians that aren't household names here in the U.S.? Are there American comedians that you really draw off of?
So the comedy, the comedians, at least, I draw a lot from the Americans. Stand-up is not really known in Iraq. It's mostly like sketch shows and stuff like that. But as far as people, my brother was a really funny kid. I mean, he's still funny, but he's 6 years older than I am. And I remember in Iraq, it's actually my earliest memory of wanting to be funny is I was sitting in a room with all of our family, and he's in sixth grade, and he has the room. He's talking, and everybody else is quiet, and they're listening, and it's because he was making them laugh. And I remember sitting there. That was my earliest memory, like, oh, my gosh, nobody ever listens to me like that.
He's got the floor, and he's got it because of his humor.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was my earliest thought, like, that's a way to grasp people. Yeah. And that was so my brother was, and then I remember, like, when we came here in America, Facebook was just a thing, and he would post funny statuses, and people react to him, and I'm like, oh, I want to be like that, I want to be like that. And then I did it.
Do you think you're able to cross boundaries because of your appearance? You joke, I've seen some of your sketch, and you joke about the fact that you don't look Iraqi compared to what Americans think an Iraqi should look like.
Right. I think that's my safety zone. If all else fails, like, I could just go in the Midwest and pretend I'm white. Like, I think that. No, I do dabble with that. I think that's super funny because when I really realized, because I used to just go up on stage and talk about being in Iraq, and then too many people would come up to me and be like, are you actually Iraqi?
I feel like if they put white kids on the news, that would have provoked the empathy to pull out of the war. Like, if you guys saw white kids, you'd have been like, oh, my God, there's people over there. So, yeah. Now I'm here. I look weird. I get it. Like, I look weird. I look like a grandpa and a grandson at the same time. What the is going on, man?
And it got to the point where I just don't know how to answer that. Like, no, I'm a racist. It's funny you ask. Yeah, I just pretend. So I just...
Is it offensive when people say you don't look Iraqi?
No, because I'm used to it. Like I said, I use humor to cope with a lot of things. So it's just, it's whatever at this point. But it just got so repetitive that I started thinking it was really funny. And then I realized, oh, people are wondering that. I should probably address it at some point in my performance. And even though I address it, it still happens. Yeah.
Do you think of yourself more of one thing or another? Like, I'm a Californian, I'm an Iraqi, I'm an American.
Oh, this definitely started off as an identity crisis. This definitely started like that. Because I was in college like 2 years in and just like not being able to connect with anyone. And it was like, oh, who am I? Like, at some point in school, middle school, people called me Jason, and then I didn't like that. And then I just kind of like, my name is Yasin. That's how it's always been said, but I know it's a lot easier to go on the tone of Yasin. So it's like, it's just like, what am I? I want to hold on to something. And I'm a Californian. I don't talk to my family that much in Iraq. So I'm like losing Arabic as far as reading and writing. And, so who do I really connect with? Am I more Californian and am I more Iraqi? And it's actually funny. I think it was when I first started, I lived 11 years in Iraq and 11 years in California. So it was right at that brink where it's like, whoa, like, which one is it? So at this point, I realized, like, no, I am really both. I have that identity and I have this amazing opportunity to grow up in California, which is something really special. And I also grew up in Iraq, and I feel like that's a privilege on its own just because of the perspective that I gained out of it. So I just really want to bring the two of those things and just make the best out of it.
Being Iraqi and not knowing the language, I end up saying, like, so much stupid stuff. Like, I remember I met my sixth grade teacher. She asked me for my full name. And Iraqis have really long full names. So I immediately told her my name is Yasin Mazen Shamsuddin Abdelamir Kadlam Hassan Kadlam Haider Ahmed Al-Haideri. She was like, you get the out of here. Like, oh, I'm not having this in my classroom. Okay, she may as well have said, this is what she said. She's like, oh, you're one of those. She tried to be nice, so she asked. She's like, oh, how many names is that? And I f***ed up and I said, around 9/11. Okay, that was my first lesson. You're not supposed to say those numbers consecutively.
In addition to making people laugh, do you hope to teach some history to the people in the audience?
Yeah, definitely. That is the ultimate goal. Like I said, the Carlin message, that is the ultimate goal, to just stand out there and let people know what is really going on. I really want that. I want to get smarter. I'm still 23. There's so much more to learn, but I know I could, if I drive myself and I really push for it, I know I could get there.
That's Yasin Mazin. Our multimedia producer, Andrew Nixon, made a video profile about Yasin and his family. You can find that video and some of Yasin's upcoming shows on our website, capradio.org/insight. Let's keep the applause going. And up next is Keith Lowell Jensen. He gets unclean on stage. We're back with Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm your host and MC today, Randall White. Today, we're getting to know some of the comics who appear on stage in Sacramento. Up next, Keith Lowell Jensen. I spoke with him earlier this month, just before he taped his next live comedy album, and asked him about the title and concept of the album, Unclean.
Unclean, yeah, because I just recorded a clean album for 800 Pound Gorilla Records, and it made me just a ton of money. So naturally, you know, I have to shoot myself in the foot and now go do a dirty one.
So unclean refers to the language.
Yeah, but I also like that it has this sort of religious connotation. you know, unclean has been used to describe, well, I don't know, people like me. What's funny, though, is I don't consider myself a particularly dirty comic. But after doing a clean album and it getting a lot of play on satellite radio, I started having people come to my shows assuming I was a clean comedian. And so I've had to give a few refunds over the last year.
Interesting.
And so I thought, well, let's make sure this one's clearly labeled so they don't buy it on accident and hurt their delicate ears. But it's not particularly dirty, but it's just not, you know, it's unclean.
So deciding content, like, what is your process for organizing material for an album?
This one's interesting because it's just such a mishmash, which I think is fun. It jumps all over the place.
So there's no big picture.
Right. And there's always been a big picture in the past, some sort. You know, there's a period where I was talking a lot about becoming a father for the first time, and then I did the album that was all about all the jobs I had. As you mentioned, I have a set that I'm working on that'll probably be my next big special about all the times I've been arrested. So this one's just like everything that couldn't go on the clean album and that wasn't about a job I had, you know, because you're still writing all the time. And so you just tucking those things away, tucking them away. And then my tuck it away file was getting pretty big. I was like, I should record. So
do you have an editor?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do. I make most of the decisions as far as the editing. But 800 Pound Gorilla Records will work with me. They're great because they never tell me I have to do anything. They always go, well, we have a market for this if you want to do it. And I'm like, you know, they're saying to me, if you like making money, here's a thing you can do. But whatever you want. You
know? How did you hook up with them?
Let's see. J.R. de Guzman, actually, another local comedian who's fantastic. He had an album, and his seemed to be doing better than mine, even though I thought that mine was better than his. Sorry, JR. So, no, JR's great. But I went to him, and I said, hey, how are they treating you? And he said, oh, I love them. And I wasn't real happy with my label at the time. So I reached out to them, and they already knew me, and they were real quick to say, yeah, let's do it. Actually, they really surprised me, because they were like, well, when do you want to record? I was like, what do you mean, when do I, you know? Next month, they'd be like, sure.
Let's do it.
Yeah, so we did. We recorded the KLJ Greatest Bits, and that's just done amazing things for me. So,
if you hit a spot where the audience isn't responding, can you just use that as a little
then
seasoning?
Then I just say, put a bleep in there so it sounds like I cursed.
Right.
No one will ever know that I didn't.
Last year, you released a lot of material, two albums and a book. Are you trying to top yourself this year?
Yeah. So another comedian was teasing me last Sunday at the Punch, saying, "Oh, so when you're up recording your album, are you going to announce the date for your next album recording?" As I mentioned, I was with a record label that I was frustrated with, and they were taking a really long time to release my stuff. So that's why I'm churning out so much stuff so quickly. Mm. It's going to slow down after this one. It's just that when they're taking 2 years to release an album, I have material piling up. I like to release something every year. Yeah. So now, you know, I released 2 recordings and a book last year, and I'm going to release 2 albums this year, and then I'm going to slow down to a normal speed.
Let's talk about the book a little bit, Punching Nazis and Other Good Ideas. What inspired that project, and have you punched any Nazis recently?
No, I've never punched a Nazi, and I confess that right from the beginning in the book. It's the book is written from a fan's perspective. I'm a huge fan of Nazi punching, but I've not partaken yet. I haven't found my opportunity, but I hope that I will. I hope that someday I will find my Nazi to punch and be in the right place to do it. So on Trump's inauguration day, Richard Spencer got punched in the face on live TV, and it went viral. And right away, in liberal circles, we all started arguing about the morality and ethics of punching Nazis. And I was like, yes, punch them all. and I felt that we are justified in doing so after, you know, millions and millions of people died the last time Nazis grabbed any kind of power. So a friend of mine, Carrie Poppy, who hosts a very popular podcast called Oh No, Ross and Carrie, was offered a book deal. And she did the delightful thing of saying, you know, I don't really have a book for you, but you should have Keith Olgensen write a book. And they were like, who? And she said, Keith Olgensen, he could write about punching Nazis. So I was so amazed to get an email saying, hi, we're from Skyhorse Publishing. Would you like to write a book about publishing Nazis? And I was like, punching, a whole book? You know? So I thought about it and went back and forth with them a little bit and then was like, yeah, I can do it. And it's funny because I've written books before, and I'll send them to one publisher and get one rejection letter, and then I can't take it, and I stop. Like with comedy, you get that immediate response. And right. If you bomb, you go out the next night and kill because you need it, you know. To spend months and months working on something and then get a rejection letter, I'm like, nah, I'll stick with the stage. This is nonsense. So it was so great to have them come to me and be like, here's an advance. Write your little heart out. And even then, when I was done with it and sent it to them, it was so nerve-wracking because I was just sure they were going to reject it. Like, be like, no, this isn't what we wanted.
You were afraid they were going to start with the compliment. This is really great, but...
Right.
And then start, you know, telling you how bad it is.
And instead, the editor said, do you know Aaron Comet Bus? And I said, he's one of my absolute favorite writers. And she said, cool, because I'm a big fan of his, and your voice reminds me of his. Not in a bad way, but it's reminiscent in a good way of his. And I was floored because not many people know Aaron Comet Bus, not as many as should. And I felt like, oh, I have an editor who actually gets what I'm trying to do. All the things where I was afraid they would be like, oh, this part's too, I don't know, doesn't go anywhere or meanders. Well, if you like Aaron Comet Bus, then you like that. And you get that. You know, another editor might have been like, nah, that needs to have more of a point, you know. So it was cool. It was a really good experience. And really, we'll probably do a soft cover version of the book next year. We've got like, I think, 1,000 copies left to sell. And then they'll let me record. Possibly an audiobook of it and a soft cover. So if you're out there, go buy it. And the funny story is it has an unfortunate Roseanne Barr quote on the cover.
Oh, it does.
And the next pressing will not. So this will be a collector's item. Go get the one with the Roseanne Barr quote.
We're speaking with comedian Keith Lowell Jensen, and he's recording a new album for 800 Pound Gorilla Records this weekend. It's called Unclean. So... you mentioned that you do have an idea for a future book.
Oh, I mean, I've written a book version of Not For Rehire.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes.
So I've written books before, and yeah, I'm sure I will write books again. But no, I actually have 2 kids' books, one of which is going to be published by Clash Books, called Tiger Torn, about a little girl helping her tiger get a job, very much inspired by my daughter. and then I have another one called Peanut Butter the Dragon, and we'll see if that can get, maybe we'll publish that as well. So, but then, yeah, I might write a grown-up book again.
What drives you? Like, what drives you to keep doing this?
Oh, I love the Woody Allen quote. I have to say he's a dirtbag every time I say his name now, right? That's the disclaimer. But I love the quote where they asked him if he was trying to achieve immortality through his work. And he said, no, I'm trying to achieve immortality through not dying. But no, I don't know what drives me. I guess it's that normal urge of just wanting to leave something of yourself.
When did you know you were funny?
Oh, I resisted it for a long time. The first time I ever got called a class clown, I took it as a huge insult. only later did I embrace it. So,
class clown is now paying the bills.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when I knew I was funny. But I remember a few times at parties where I sort of held court being funny. And then there's this weird mix of like being proud of yourself and also some self-loathing because you're like, oh, I made myself the center of attention. So the stage is so great because it's like,
you're supposed to be doing that.
It's said the lights are aimed at you. The microphone's pointed at you. It's set up for that. You're raised up a little bit. And now I have so much more fun at parties because now at parties I don't want to be the center of attention at all. I'm like, I'm just here as an observer.
If your child shows an inclination to go in that same direction as you, what will be your response?
She's already there. Yeah, we're waiting to go on stage together. She's writing jokes. She's doing. What's funny is that the first comedy I introduced her to was Mitch Hedberg, so she thinks every joke has to be said in Mitch Hedberg's rhythm. She's like, "Daddy, I wrote a joke," and then the joke starts. I like oranges. She just Mitch Hedberg's every joke, but she's already writing jokes and good jokes. So, yeah, I would tell you one. But when I've done that before, she gets mad at me. She's like, Dad, you didn't do it right. So I'm like, all right, baby.
It's all in the delivery, Dad. Yeah, come on.
So I blow her jokes. But yeah, we'll get on stage together one of these days.
That's Keith Lowell Jensen. He just recorded a new album, Unclean, earlier this month, and it will be released on 800-pound Gorilla Records later this year. Are you feeling good? Let's keep the laughs going for our next comedian, Hari Kondabolu, coming up after this break. This is the comedy show on Insight from your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. Thanks for sticking with us on Insight. I'm your host and MC today, Randall White. Hari Kondabolu is known as a political comedian born and raised in Queens, New York. His fans and fellow comics around the world count him as one of the sharpest and funniest voices in the U.S. He's also an actor, filmmaker, activist, and podcast host. Hari spoke with Hey Listen host Nick Bruner for Insight back in March of 2017. So give a warm Insight welcome to Hari Kondabolu.
You know, historically, I didn't talk about politicians very much. I did when I had to. It's like sports. Like, if you know sports, you can talk sports. And if you don't know sports, then you don't want to talk about sports. Narrow about it. I care about topics and big issues and how it affects people's lives and that kind of stuff. But now, you know, this isn't your normal presidency. This is very atypical. And I don't mean that in the best ways. Like, obviously, we're questioning the importance of the media. We're questioning, like, healthcare and all these fundamental things are being questioned in a very short period of time. It means that I have to keep up and I can't ignore what's happening. So if the comedian's responsibility is to address what's in the room or, you know, address what's in the air, that's there. You can't ignore that. If anything, it helps comics like Kamau and I who talk about big things because we don't need to explain as much. The president tweets something and that's our starting point. This is why it's relevant. This man just tweeted something, and that gets us to the bigger topic, hopefully.
Do you find that American comedy audiences specifically are bringing more of an awareness to politics?
You know, there are people I've seen protest in March that I have never seen protest in March before. It has activated people in a way I have never seen. Usually when people are activated like this, it's about a very specific reason. I'm against war. I support fair immigration reform, whatever it is. This is just the whole idea of a person being president who's insulted so many people and is questioning so many fundamental things about America. So when I talk to audiences, it's not to say everybody's on the same page, but they at least know that like something is happening and it's not agreed upon and there's turmoil. And even if you like Trump, he's a divisive candidate, which you can see. It doesn't mean people are going to get the narrowest things, nor do I like talking about the narrowest things. but at least it raises the bar a little bit because the whole country is on fire right now.
One of the things I have noticed that you do enjoy talking about on stage is race.
I don't see it as separate from myself. It's not like I'm thinking I have to talk about race right now. My lens is such where that's something I observe and experience and can write about quickly and understand. And, you know, like two comics can see a situation and, you know, one takes something superficial out of it. Like, you know, what's the deal with the way the police, you know, wear ridiculous hats? And I might look at it and say, like, cops have guns, that scares me. Those are two different angles. One is about clothing and one's about, like, life and death. And it's not to say that I don't see the hat also, but my first instinct is to talk about the gun and violence and fear. That's my first instinct. You know, I think about race a lot. It's my first observation. To me, this is observational comedy. Race, gender, sexuality, that's like stuff I pick up on quickly. It's my first instinct. My first reaction to pain has always been humor as a self-defense. So that's exactly what I'm doing. Like, I'm defending myself.
And I see that your documentary, The Problem with Apu, was picked up. Would you tell me a little bit about what that project is?
Sure. True TV allowed me to make this film I'd wanted to make for quite some time. It's currently called The Problem with Apu. And it's just about that character of Apu Nahasapima Petalan from The Simpsons, you know, the convenience store owner, and the fact that it was the only major South Asian character on television for most of my childhood. That's what people saw when they saw a brown person, and what that does. Like, what impact does that make on an individual, on a community, what that says about us? Like, we wouldn't make a regular character on a show like Apu now. It would seem corny or over the top, very stereotypical, but that character's grandfathered in. And how does that fit where we are today? What's gotten better? What hasn't? What does minstrelsy look like? We have a history of that in this country. And where does this fit into that? You know, I was able to interview a lot of friends who are performers and, you know, politicians and a broad range of experiences. And, you know, I think we created a really interesting film.
Did you get a chance to speak with voice actor and notable white person Hank Azaria, who voices Apu?
Notable. I'm not saying. I think people should watch the film. I
Fair
mean, that's
enough.
Kind of, that is certainly a part of the movie, our search for Hank. So I'm going to leave that there for people to see.
What do you expect from hardcore Simpsons fans? How do you expect they'll digest your documentary when they see it? And what do you expect back from them?
I mean, I think it's a range, just like people are a range. I think some people are going to be really upset because they don't want The Simpsons questioned. You know, they'll think I'm a killjoy or I don't understand The Simpsons, or some people will whine political correctness. But the thing about Simpsons fans is that they're also extremely smart, right? It's not a homogenous group, but there's a lot of, like, you know, I love The Simpsons. First of all, that has to be acknowledged. Like, I'm a huge Simpsons fan. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do comedy. It made me believe that you're allowed to be smart and say something and be silly at the same time. Like, you could have heart when you had a joke. Like, it could have intention. Like, that all starts in a lot of ways with The Simpsons. And I think a lot of Simpsons fans see that and understand The Simpsons critiques everything. They go after everything, and they're really clever. So why would they have an issue with someone going after them? If you love something, that doesn't mean you can't criticize it. That's how I feel about America. You can love America, and that might be the reason you're criticizing it to begin with, because you have a greater investment in it. And that's how I'm approaching this film. So I hope Simpsons fans see that.
So now, with a politically reactive podcast, you and Kamau have interviewed people like Jake Tapper and Van Jones and Rachel Maddow. I'm curious, what are major cable news organizations getting right, and where are they dropping the ball?
I feel like the media is getting caught up in the president's tweets. You know, I realize it's unprecedented for the president to tweet in response to a Saturday Night Live sketch. But when we got caught up into that, you know, we're being distracted from Russia. We're being distracted from women's rights being destroyed in the health care bill and all the people that aren't going to be insured. We're ignoring a lot of things that might be a conflict of interest. We, you know, he's planting things, and we, you know, the media just flocks to it without questioning why it's happening. He knows how to work the media. He knows how to say, look over there while he does something else, and we fall for it every time. So I think overall, like, it's been okay, but, I, you know, and certainly it's been more aggressive, and there's been a harder critique, at a president who has a combative relationship with the media. I just wish that we kept the eyes on the prize.
So if I were to hand you the keys to, say, CNN or NPR or even Capital Public Radio here in Sacramento and say, OK, you're now the news director, what would you change about the scope of the political coverage that we're providing?
I'd begin by talking about what I ate for breakfast that morning, then go into various career stories and interviews with friends and other acquaintances. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody should put me in charge of anything where I can basically be the egomaniac that I am deep on the inside. But I think we'd probably focus less on his internet presence. Tweets are, they're not essays, they're not real complicated public statements. They're instant responses to things. You know, they don't reflect larger policy decisions. If we were to talk about what he tweeted, I think it's a, you know, like a footnote. I don't think it requires four people from around the world to be on TV via satellite and talk about what the president tweeted and what that means. So chances are I'd probably just focus on the legislation part. I'd see how that would affect various people and make that the thing. I feel like our dependence on what people on the internet are saying is a little ridiculous.
So clearly you're no fan of Donald Trump's, if I can put words in your mouth.
That's fair. That's a very polite way to say it, yes.
What, if anything, do you see that could be considered a positive from his presidency?
I think, you know, one positive potentially long-term from this presidency is that it crystallizes a movement on the left. It crystallizes a sense of unity. I mean, when I'm at these marches, I've seen a lot more intersections of different issues. People talk about Black Lives Matter while at the Women's March, because both of those things are connected and both of those things are being attacked. Things like that, like the fact he's going after everybody, forces us to come together. So I'm hoping it activates tons of people around the country who are really engaging in democracy for the first time. There are kids who are seeing what's happening. And Trump speaks in a way that kids understand, for better or worse. And they know he's mean just by the way he speaks. And I feel like even things like that, you know, that's going to motivate a generation not to go down that road again, I hope. I also hope this is rock bottom for democracy. I really hope we see this and are like, this is what happens when you're not careful. This is what happens when you give attention to someone who isn't a serious candidate, who just likes to make a lot of noise, you know, who is saying hateful things. This is what happens. So I'm hoping, like, maybe this is a turning point in the history of our democracy, and that is the most optimistic way to look at it. You know, it's funny. I know that sounds so negative, but like it really comes from optimism. I feel like this has to go somewhere. We're fighting for something.
That's comedian Hari Kondabolu speaking with Hey Listen host Nick Bruner back in March of 2017. Since that conversation aired, Hari released a documentary called The Problem with Apu about the Simpsons character and a Netflix comedy series called Warn Your Relatives. Coming up, we'll preview the Sacramento stand-up competition. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight. I'm your host and MC today, Randall White. We have one more round of laughs for you today, courtesy of the Sacramento stand-up competition. It's a weekend-long event where comics from Sacramento, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, and beyond get on stage, and it's happening this weekend, July 25th through the 27th. Last week, I sat down with comedian Melissa McGillicuddy and Sacramento Comedy Spot founder Brian Krall.
First of all, I really don't like doing competitions. It is hard to do a competition of something that is an art form, and it's something that is subjective. You don't think of Sacramento as a comedy town. You think of New York or L.A. or Chicago. We wanted to start bringing people to Sacramento, so one of the ways to do that is to have a competition. But I wanted to make sure it was a competition that really took care of performers. You come into town, we try to set people up with food. We try to find other comedians in our community that you can stay with if you're coming from out of town. We only invite 24 people. We could invite 90. You know, we're inviting 24. The odds of you making it and getting the grand prize are 1 out of 24, which is a lot better than 1 out of 100, you know. So we really try to take care of our talent. That's our number one thing. We want them to have a great experience in a town that is turning into a comedy town.
Well, let's talk about the audience a little bit. Melissa, how is the audience involved in this whole process? How do they track what's happening over the weekend?
I think the audience is there mostly just to see a great show and a great weekend. The way that judging works is that one of the criteria is audience reaction. Mm-hmm. So the judges are looking at how is the audience reacting to that.
You don't have like one of those applause meters, right?
No. It's just sort of taking it in, you know, how is the audience responding to the humor? That's sort of one element of it, which I think I appreciate that because there are some competitions where the audience has a say or a vote. And I think sometimes that just comes down to who brought the most people.
Yeah, right.
I appreciate that the judges are looking at the audience as far as how they're reacting, but it's not really up to the audience to pick a winner.
Let's listen to some people who nailed it in past years. Mm-hmm. They've figured out how to master the different elements of the rubric. Let's start with Khairi Shabazz. We should mention he recently performed on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and he's homegrown to some degree, Sacramento Bay Area.
Yeah.
Now is in L.A. Let's listen to this clip.
My old job, all the white coworkers would sit together in one group during lunch, and all of us minorities sat together in a group. And the manager was afraid that there was some racial tension and had to explain to her, like, no, those white dudes are just talking about stuff we don't want to talk about. Like hops and IPAs. Podcasts. Movies J.J. Abrams directed. Like, who is J.J. Abrams? You know? And us minorities, we were talking about things they weren't interested in, like freedom and equality. Like, they didn't want to.
That's the second or third time I've heard that now, and it makes me laugh each time.
I know.
The podcast one, of course, gets me working in public radio.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What was it about Khairi that really showed he was successful the year that he won, which was 2016?
2016. I think that clip is a really good example of what Khairi is fantastic at. Like, he has a joke that is layered with social commentary, right? But it's hilarious. I mean, it's just a great crafted joke.
Because at first you're like, uh-oh, racial tension, what are we going to be talking about here?
Right.
And part of comedy is to make you uncomfortable, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you're playing it safe all the time, it just doesn't have the impact, right? But he's able to craft a joke that does make you maybe a little bit nervous, mm-hmm. like, how's this thing going to go down? But then it pays off, and it's so smart.
We should mention the people we're listening to right now are the headliners for this year's event.
Yeah, they're coming back and performing. So Khairi is going to be headlining the showcase, which is at 7 o'clock. It's the earlier show right before the finals.
And then the winner from 2017 is Krista Fotka.
Krista Fotka, yeah.
And let's hear a clip from her.
Damn, I got a Fitbit. Yeah, I got it off of a dead body, but she looks amazing. She was in really good shape. So I feel like my life is headed in a really positive direction. You familiar with the technology? Hey, living that Fitbit life? Yes. I don't know if you guys know, you're more of an iWatch crowd. Okay, falling out of control. No, it's, if you're not familiar, it looks like a watch. Feels like a low self-esteem timer. Just every hour or so kind of rattles you like, hey, notice you haven't been moving around a whole lot. Might want to get to stepping.
She's great.
Yeah. Krista, I don't fangirl for very many comedians, especially like we're sort of in the same scene, but man, right. Every time I see her, it's like very much a celebrity moment. I'm like, hey, Krista, good to see you.
Remember me?
Yeah. Hey.
She's so good.
Yeah.
She's so good.
Yeah,
she's one of my favorite
for
comedians.
For sure. Yeah. And I've heard that bit so many times, but I just laughed right now.
Yeah.
Like I hadn't ever heard it. You know, it's just great.
Earlier in the hour, we heard from two different comedians, and I asked them, when did you know you were funny? And Melissa, I want to pose that question to you. At what point did you know you were funny?
I think I'm still waiting to figure that.
I think a lot of people might disagree with you.
So. No, but yeah, sorry, that was just a hack joke that I thought I would throw out to get a couple cheap laughs. I think really early on as a kid, comedy was a big part of growing up. My mom and I watched a lot of stuff like In Living Color and Saturday Night Live. And I was thinking about, my mom had her own business for a while, and I remember as a little kid getting behind, like hiding behind the couch and doing impressions of her clients. And so, you know, she couldn't see me, but it was like, who's this? You know, right. and I would act out or, you know, voice out who her different clients were, and just doing silly stuff like that. I remember doing a lot of impressions when I was a kid, and then realizing as I went, you know, got older in high school and stuff, that comedy was a way for me to be able to get people to talk to me or connect with people, because I wasn't, like, believe it or not, I wasn't one of the cool popular kids. So
it was an attention tool.
Yeah. I mean, just humor was a way that I was able to function in awkward, anxiety like situations, because I have a lot of that.
Brian, you mentioned earlier there are 24 people that will be competing, and we have some clips from some of those people. Jessica Wellington, she's out of Los Angeles.
This is really cool. So Jessica, a long time ago, worked at the Comedy Spot. She moved to LA. She's been down there for, I don't even know how many years, a long time now. And she is the first woman door person at the Comedy Store, which is a big deal, because you're not just working the door, you're being mentored by comedians. You get stage time. This is a person that never thought she would be doing comedy. And now she does podcast called Liars Club with some of the best comedians in the business. So
cool. Let's hear the clip.
You guys, I'm fat. Let's just go ahead and... I know it. You know, I'm fat. I was actually in the Air Force. I wasn't always fat. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's just hard for me because, like, my idea of a diet is just eating the curliest of the fries. You know? And I find that, like, I eat my emotions, you know? I think a lot of us do. I eat my emotions, and I have a lot of hate inside. A lot. And I find that, like, steak and potatoes, and chocolate and ice cream, they feel that hate really nicely, you know? Yeah. And then, you guys, I thought about it. The word hate is just ate with a fork. Right.
So, gonna play on. How do play on words work well?
They can.
I think
when it's good.
It's that is a pretty good, joke. Yeah. I mean, you don't see that coming. I think it's just a really good crafted joke.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's listen to a Sacramento local, Emma Haney.
Yeah, Emma's been in the scene for a while. I don't think she's ever been in the competition before, has she?
I don't think so. I don't think she particularly likes competitions. I get. They're, you know, it's very stressful. But she's definitely one of my favorite Sacramento comedians. So I'm so glad that she decided to be a part of it this year.
I think that's what's fun, too, about the competition is we do have some local talent that get into the competition. But we're putting them in the competition because they've earned a place in the competition. You know, we're not putting them in there because they're just locals. So it's really exciting. You get to be around people from all over the country, and at the same time, you're almost like representing Sacramento.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, we do have, I mean, no brag, just fact. I mean, we do have a great comedy scene here. I mean, if you look at the last 3 years of the stand-up NBC competition, those have all been Sacramento comics that won that.
Oh, wow. So, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Kyrie, JR.
And Mikey Winfield.
Mikey Winfield, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I got divorced because I just came out this past year. You guys are way more supportive than my husband was. That's great. He's just like, what? I'm like, I wear jean on jean. I don't know what to tell you. You should have seen it coming. It was such a weird thing, though, because my husband and I, we were together from when I was 19 until I was 27 years old. Right? That's a long time. And, like, having to, like, come out to someone after all, it's like, I was, like, super nervous and I didn't know what to do. And I remember we were just eating dinner one night. And he was just like, oh, hey, babe, how's it going? Like, how was your day? And I got super nervous. I was just like, I like goodbye. And I just flew away in a Subaru that appeared outside my house. So I had a Home Depot gift card in the front seat. I'm like, oh.
All right, that was Emma Haney. There's many more that we just don't have time to get to right now, but I want to wish all of them the best of luck coming up. And Brian Krall co-founder, manager, Sacramento Comedy Spot, also the guy who came up with this whole competition. Thanks for being here today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And also the stand-up program director at the Comedy Spot, Melissa McGillicuddy. Really fun to interview you
again. Yeah, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
That's Brian Krall with the Comedy Spot and Melissa McGillicuddy speaking with me about the Sacramento stand-up competition. The festivities start tonight at the Sacramento Comedy Spot in Midtown, and it runs through Saturday, July 27th. That's it for the comedy show on Insight today. It's been an honor to be your host and MC. My name is Randall White. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We get help from Antonio Munez, Nick Bruner, and Helen Barrington. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Don't forget to tip your waitstaff, and thanks for joining us.